Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5, 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network, and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and the Gordon Law School, please visit my webpage. It's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on journalistic fraud right after this message. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor. And we're taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if a plumber said he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? What if a carpenter said that? He who fixes his own steps as a fool for a client. Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who can't fix his own pipes or steps is incompetent? Well, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or carpenter. Now, listen to James Nielsen. He's a professor of law, a law school professor at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he had to say. Quote, "It is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed." It's worse than that. He said, most students do in fact graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed, and a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel, and a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, it is a cruel hoax. Now, that's Professor James Nielsen, Hastings Law School. For more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967. While you're at it, be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedure is available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, why don't you go to my website, it's georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. That's the place to start. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. We've been talking about journalistic fraud, a book written by Bob Cohn, published by WND Books. You can go to the webpage of WND Books. It's www.wndbooks.com. I'll tell you more about that in a little bit. You know, when we read the newspaper, we believe what it says because we believe what we read in the paper. Why shouldn't we? Distortion of the truth is a lie. Spin is the politically correct way to lie. The New York Times wire service is a lie. Brainwashing is the business of creating a lie and then making you believe it. The New York Times is the champion. Fraud is a lie. And they use push-pull crusades, flooding the zone, quoting someone who agrees with us, straight news articles, distorted interpretation, and news analysis to deceive us. Now let's take a look at facts. You know, before we can make a decision, we have to have all of the facts. We believe that when we read the paper or listen to Dan Rather, we're getting the facts. After all, they're showing us pictures and telling us a story. We believe that we're getting the facts. But are we getting the facts? Well, distorting the facts, Slanting the facts is the most basic tool in an editor's stock of techniques to bias a story in favor of the publisher's editorial point of view. Facts may be slanted in four basic ways. Number one, we can use omission. Number two, we can use distortion. Number three, we can use outright falsification. Or four, we can use emphasis. So, to slant the facts, we use omission, distortion, falsification, and emphasis. Now, let's take a look at the way we can use omission, distortion, falsification, and emphasis to deceive. Let's take omitting key facts. You know, the omission of key facts is a form of slant that is nearly impossible to detect and one that will always provide the editors with plausible deniability. Should a reporter ever be caught doing it, a paper can always claim ignorance or contend that the omission was inadvertent. A newspaper can slant by omission to either harm their opponents or help its allies. Now, here's a front page example of how the Times omitted a key fact to the detriment of one of its political opponents. They did this on July 9th, 2002. The story is entitled, or it's bylined, Washington, July 8th. Quote, President Bush defended himself today against a barrage of questions about his own dealings, even as he vowed to take a tougher line in a speech in New York on Tuesday against corrupt corporate executives. As pressures mounted today from Democrats in Congress, Mr. Bush repeatedly dismissed criticism that he had failed to disclose a 1990 stock sale as nothing more than a political attack, although he acknowledged that he still did not know why the sale had not been disclosed as promptly as required by law. Unquote. Now, there's the story. Is there something omitted from this story that we ought to have which would change our view or opinion or conclusion that we now have in our minds based upon what we just heard? Now, it appears that Bush sold some stock and didn't report it correctly. Now, that's what we've been led to believe. Is it true? Well, as suggested in the previous chapter, you can always put a Republican on the defensive by emphasizing that he's responding to criticism. So there's another buzzword. Responding to criticism. So if I'm criticizing you, you have to respond. That has a negative connotation. The criticism is true, and you're responding to it. Now, here in a variation of that theme, Bush defended himself, another buzzword, Bush defended himself, a political observation that is given emphasis by placing at the beginning of the lead sentence the actual what of the story that the president gave a speech in which he took a tough line against corporate corruption was given secondary treatment in the lead. You see, President Bush is giving a statement. He says, I'm going to take a tough line on these corporate chiselers and cheats. But the newspaper reports that Bush is defending himself, not that he's attacking corporate corruption. Ah, starting to get the drift of what's going on here? It's like asking the question, are you still beating your wife on Wednesday? We put you on the defensive by calling you a wife beater. We don't have any evidence that you're even married, much less a wife beater, and besides that, you may be beating up on your girlfriend on Thursdays rather than your wife on Wednesday. But assuming these facts, which aren't in evidence, we lead the reader to believe that, and that's what we're doing here. We're leading you to believe that. So as suggested in the previous chapter, you can always put a Republican on the defensive by emphasizing that he's responding to criticism, defending himself, And later in the same news article, the Times stated, or should we say, opined. Here's what they said. Quote, "It was unclear whether Mr. Bush's news conference would put the questions behind him, particularly because he offered less of an explanation today than he and his advisors have in the past for why he was 8 months late disclosing his 1990 sale of Harkin stock on a document called a Form 4. Now, perhaps the Times would have looked foolish publishing that opinion had they not omitted a critical fact about the president's Harkin stock sale. You see, the fact that it was properly disclosed. The specific information the Times apparently chose to suppress was that several days before Bush sold his Harkin stock, he properly disclosed the sale to the SEC on what is called the Form 144. By properly filing the Form 144 before he sold the stock, the late filing of the Form 4, due only after the sale, was insignificant. The Form 144 effectively put the public on notice that he was going to sell his shares. So it's not enough. You know, it's not as though the Times reporter could have missed this fact when asked at his press conference why he was late in filing a stock sale report. The Form 4, remember, the president answers, "When I made the decision to sell, I filed a Form 144. I think you all have copies of that Form 144. It's an intention to sell, and I did sell." So the reporter had the information that Bush had filled out the Form 144. But he doesn't report that fact. He reports the fact that Bush did not file the Form 4, which was no longer necessary, or it was certainly less important. See the way we do that? Bush then, it looks like, is one of these scheming corporate defrauders like Ken Lay at Enron, because he too sells stock and doesn't make the proper filings. Well, that's called a lie by omission. So the Times is lying to us about Bush, and I've mentioned this time and time again. The worst thing that you can do to someone is tell the truth about them. The best thing you can do to someone is to lie about them. Boy, I'd whole lot rather you lie about me than tell the truth about me. Because if you lie about me, I can uncover those lies and expose you for the liar that you are. But if you tell the truth about me, how am I going to overcome you telling the truth about me? There's no defense against truth. There's lots of defense against lies. And that's what we're doing here. We're exposing the New York Times for what it is. It's a lying rag, like the Hearst Yellow journalism of the 1800s and early 1900s. It's just a yellow journal rag, the New York Times. Piece of trash. It always has been. It is now. And without a doubt, it will probably continue to be the same. What indication do you have that it's going to change? Now, I don't care if you read it, and I don't care if you believe it, but you ought to be informed that what you're reading there is fiction. If you want to read fiction, why don't you buy Harlequin? So as suggested in the previous chapter, you can always put a Republican on the defensive by emphasizing that he's responding to criticism. And here's the president responding to the criticism of, why didn't you file this Form 4? The president filed the Form 144, and he's responding to this criticism. Again, the Form 4 is the form you file with the SEC after you sell your shares. This was the one that was filed late and referred to in the Times article. The article entirely omitted any reference to the more important form, the Form 144, which Bush filed properly and on time. So as the president said repeatedly, Form 144 was the important document because the 144 was filed properly before he sold the stock. There could be no harm done to the public by the late filing of the Form 4 after he sold the stock, which would essentially add no new material information. So the omission, however, of the fact about the properly filed Form 144 allowed the Times to position the entire article around the Harkin stock sale, rather than the efforts the president was making to strengthen the rules on the scandalous activities that were making news, Enron, for instance, Global Crossing and WorldCom, activities that basically arose out of ethics lapses that took place during the tenure of the Clinton administration, and also a fact not mentioned in the Times article. So when we were talking about Enron, WorldCom, Global Crossing, and these multinational corporations with the stock fraud, Bush wasn't in office, and there were no Bush policies in place when these abuses were going on. These abuses were taking place under the Clinton administration. How come the Clinton Securities and Exchange Commission wasn't on top of Enron and all of the skullduggery that was going on at that time? Again, we're talking about errors of omission. We're going to report all of the bad things about Bush, but we're not going to report any of the bad things about Clinton. We'll report all the good things about Clinton and all the bad things about Bush. Is that objective reporting, or is that partisan politics? It's partisan politics, and it ought to be labeled as such. Always liked Howard Dean. I'm not a Democrat, and I don't follow socialist communist philosophy, but Dean was at least honest when he said, I'm opposed to the war, and here's why. I think it sucks. The New York Times was opposed to the war, but they took a neutral stance and said, we're not for or against it, we're just reporting the facts. That was a lie. Nevertheless, the tactical omission enabled the Times to undermine the president's efforts against corporate fraud with the following headline in the most influential newspaper in the country. Bush defends sale of stock and vows to enhance the SEC. Bush had not defended his stock sale. He provided details about how it was publicly disclosed. As if this were not enough, the story was accompanied by an editorial news analysis. It also appeared on the front page under the headline, Old Business in New Light, 90 Stock Sale by Bush Shadows Ethics Drive. Now do you see why President Bush holds so few news conferences and why President Clinton held news conferences every week? And that's because the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times are liberal, yellow journal sheets. And so, politically, while Bush is an insider with skull and bones and is working for the New World Order, the Committee of 300 doesn't really care whether there's a Democrat or a Republican in office. They control both sides. Nixon had the same problem. He'd get up there and he'd tell his story and it would be perverted. Johnson, it got to the point where he would get up there and tell his story and it would be perverted. And that's the power that you have with journalism. I have that power here on the air. Now the difference is that what we're trying to do is to expose the lies in the public interest so that you can make a more informed decision as to what it is you believe and what you think. I mean, after all, shouldn't you have a right to think for yourself rather than have the New York Times do your thinking for you? Well, in order for you to think, you have to have facts. Well, if you get your facts from the New York Times, you'll probably be disappointed. That's why the Bible says that you want to study to show yourself approved, a workman that needs not to be ashamed. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour and the editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this program are just a small part of my two-week basic courtroom strategy and procedures class. Remember, this class includes lessons on what to do and what not to do at the arrest or when you're served with a summons, citation, or a complaint. Rule number one is don't say anything. Keep your mouth shut and shut up. Now, if you can learn that rule one, you can win about 86% of your legal cases as a pro se litigant. And that's because all of the evidence that's going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. And your government is fully capable of making their own case without any help from you whatsoever. So don't give the prosecution a victory. Make them work for it. Listen to what the courts have to say about keeping quiet in the face of police interrogation. Indeed, in many cases, police intimidation. Who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights? That's a citation from U.S. versus Dickerson. A second judge put it this way. He said, you can and must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment in Belknap versus U.S. And the third judge said the constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent as well as the innocent and the farsighted in Marchetti versus United States. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. That's the place to start. That's number one. That's a 4-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. And courtroom strategy and procedure is available on compact disc for adult home education. That's on CD with all of the paperwork so you can study at home. If you're online, you go to the website georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're looking at a book called Journalistic Fraud. It's about a 1 in 20 book. I rate it. Sometimes I rate books, you know, 1 in 100, a 1 in 20. The reason for that is you'll read 20 books before you find one that's really got some good information in it that you didn't know before or that's valuable. This is one of those. There's a lot of books written on journalism and a lot of books written on fraud and lies and corruption that goes on. This is an outstanding work written by a fellow named Bob Cohn. He used to work for the New York Times. He's an insider, and he's giving you the straight skinny here on here's what's going on inside the New York Times. If we wanted to know what's going on inside of Microsoft, we're going to have somebody from Microsoft write us a book and tell us. If we want to know what's going on inside the Justice Department, somebody's going to have to become a whistleblower and tell us here's what's going on. Well, you can get a copy of this from Barnes & Noble, $27.95. Remember, the name of the book, Journalistic Fraud, How the New York Times Distorts the News and Why It Can No Longer Be Trusted. Bob Cohn is the author, and the publisher is WND Books, Nashville, Tennessee. WND.com. www.wnd.com, and that'll help you get started to get a copy. All right, let's take a look here at the article began with the following lead. Listen to this. The news analysis, which also omitted the key fact about the properly filed Form 144. News analysis. These are the experts. They get on the television and they start talking back and forth among themselves. These news analysts also omitted the key fact about the properly filed Form 144. Actually suggested that the failure to file this meaningless Form 4 on time was analogous to the Clinton Whitewater scandal. Now, in a front-page article in the Times under the headline Questions on Halliburton Deal Under Cheney on August 1, 2002, the Times successfully created, by this same technique of factual omission, the impression that Vice President Cheney had an illegal financial motive for selling his Halliburton stock. And the article began with the following lead. This is Washington, July 31st. Quote, with Washington focused on corporate responsibility, Vice President Dick Cheney's tenure is under scrutiny from government investigators and his political opponents. Unquote. Now, the article, however, fails to identify a single government agency or investigator who the reporters allege to be investigating the deal referred to in the headline. Let's take a look at this again. It says, with Washington focused on corporate responsibility, Vice President Dick Cheney's tenure is under scrutiny from government investigators and his political opponents. Which government investigators, who are the political opponents that are investigating Dick Cheney? None. and none are reported. But it leaves us with the impression that Cheney is doing something that's illegal, like Enron, and is under investigation for it, when in fact that's not true. Now, it seems rather that the allegations of scrutiny of the deal, Halliburton's acquisition of a company who later disclosed, previously unbeknownst to Halliburton, the existence of asbestos liability, were raised entirely by the Times. For example, presumably the political opponents to whom the articles alluded. Moreover, the paper cleverly employed the technique of factual omission. You see, after the so-called scrutiny of Cheney's involvement in a deal that turned out financially disappointing, the paper stated, quote, Halliburton's stock has fallen sharply as the extent of the asbestos problem has become clear since Mr. Cheney left the company to join the Republican presidential ticket in August of 2000. Thus, the paper suggests then that the fallen stock price was caused by the asbestos problem, a supposition for which there was neither factual support nor even a reasonable basis, especially given the precipitous decline in the stock market during that same period. But the glaring omission comes with the next sentence of the article. It says, quote, Mr. Cheney sold nearly $40 million in Halliburton stock around the time he left the company at prices above $50 a share. The stock closed yesterday at $13.20. Now, that clearly suggests insider trading, doesn't it? The clear implication is that Cheney may have known about the asbestos problem and that it would cause the stock to drop, and so he sold the stock with this in mind. Insider trading. Omitted from the article, however, were the circumstances of the sale which had previously been reported. That is, the fact that Cheney sold the stock at great reluctance shortly after he became Bush's vice presidential nominee. He made the sales only after having been hounded by reporters on the issue, culminating in an editorial in the Washington Post that demanded that he divest his stock to eliminate any potential conflict of interest. So the papers were saying, if you want to run for vice president, you sell your stock. So Cheney did, and he sold it at $50. Then when the stock declined to $13, they turned around and turned on him and said, ah, insider trading, you knew what was happening. See, this is why the adage that a Republican is always defending himself. Well, had the reporters included this background, readers, including other journalists, could come to an informed opinion as to what might have been Cheney's real motives with respect to his sales of Halliburton stock. Now, I'll tell you something that really bothers me. Halliburton got their contracts over in Iraq without any competitive bidding. The law requires competitive bidding, you know. I don't hear the New York Times or anybody else complaining about that. I'm complaining about it because it's illegal. I'm complaining about it because it bars any other companies and all of their employees from participating in the American system of the free marketplace. I object to it because of the ripoff that Halliburton is imposing through their one of their companies called Brown & Root. I mean, there's all kinds of fraud and chicanery going on. I don't see why they don't tell the truth about the real fraud and chicanery. I think that the truth would serve our purposes better. These people lie when the truth would serve their purpose better. They act like a bunch of hillbillies in a whorehouse with a credit card. Well, let's take a break. You're listening to The Law Hour in the Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this program are just a small part of my 2-week basic courtroom strategy and procedure school. And this class includes lessons on what to do and what not to do at the scene of the alleged crime and what you should say to the police or investigators and what you ought to keep your mouth shut about, what not to say to the police. And you'll learn how to conduct yourself in your case at bail setting, arraignment, pleadings, motion, hearings, trial, and appeal. And I'll teach you how to ask questions, cross-examine adverse witnesses, select a jury, introduce exhibits and evidence, and conduct discovery, do legal research, and follow the rules of court. Now, there's 28 things you need to know, 28 elements to learn in courtroom strategy and procedure. Not 280 or 2,800, just 28 things that you need to know. Rule one is that all of the evidence that your opponent is ever going to use against you is going to be furnished by you. So to preclude that, keep your mouth shut. Don't say anything and shut up. After rule one's out of the way, we can get to the real business of winning your case. If you want more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, call the law school. The number's 417-273-4967. And be sure to ask for my free General Law CD package. That's a 4-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge, and courtroom strategy and procedures available on compact disc for adult home study. But before we get into training you, why don't you get online, go to the website georgegordon.org, click onto the email, and send me an email request for your free General Law CD package first. Doesn't cost anything to inquire. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing the New York Times, Journalistic Fraud, published by Bob Cohn. How the New York Times distorts the news and why it can no longer be trusted, a 1 in 20 read. I recommend it to all of my listeners. And tonight's special report on journalistic fraud is available for $27.95 at Barnes & Noble, or from the publisher, and it's wndbooks.com. WND.com. They're in Nashville, Tennessee. Well, I'm not here to defend John Ashcroft, Dick Cheney, or George Bush. I'm here to defend the truth. Now, when George Bush tells the truth, then we ought to accept it as the truth, and it's at face value. When somebody lies about George Bush, Dick Cheney, or John Ashcroft, they ought to be exposed for the lying sacks of bull manure that they are. Pure and simple. Same thing's true with Bill Clinton or any other politician or economist or anybody else. You know, we've got laws that say you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor, and then we go out here and we lie about people when the truth would serve our purpose better. Don't you think? So lying by omission is just one of the methodologies that we see employed. We can also distort key facts. The distortion of facts is riskier than bias by omission, but it seems that as long as the distortion supports the Times' political ends, the means are justified. The worst case will be a correction published days or weeks later in a section of the paper that few people are going to read. For instance, recall our earlier reference to the crusade that the Times waged against President Bush's approach to the war on terrorism with a relentless series of editorials and slanted news articles throughout 2002. This crusade included a front-page article that seized on opinion articles written by prominent Republicans offering their thoughts on the best way to proceed against Iraq. The headline said, "Top Republicans Break with Bush on Iraq Strategy," published August 16, 2002. And it's worded like this: Washington, August the 15th, leading Republicans from Congress, the State Department, and past administrations have begun to break ranks with President Bush over his administration's high-profile planning for war with Iraq, saying that the administration has neither adequately prepared for military action nor made the case that it is needed. These senior Republicans include former Secretary of State Henry A. Kissinger and Brent Scowcroft, the first President Bush's national security advisor. All right, to support its conclusion then that Kissinger broke ranks with the president on his Iraq policy, The Times published abbreviated quotes from a Kissinger op-ed piece, and it said, quote, "In an opinion article published on Monday in the Washington Post, Mr. Kissinger made a long and complex argument about the international complications of any military campaign, writing that American policy will be judged by how the aftermath of the military operation is handled politically, a statement that seems to play well with the State Department strategy. Military intervention should be attempted only if we're willing to sustain such an effort for however long it is needed," he added. Now, there was nothing in these quotes that even suggests that there's a divergence between Kissinger's view and that of the administration on either the goal or the means of a preemptive move against Iraq. On the contrary, Kissinger, in his opinion, called preemptive action imperative, and he stated, quote, "The imminence of proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, the huge danger that it involves, the rejection of a viable inspection system, and the demonstrated hostility of Hussein combine to produce an imperative for preemptive action." But that's not what was reported, was it? And it's these distortions, then, that cause us to believe a lie. Then, a little later on, you know, a week later, they'll come back and say, "We want to make a correction. We made a mistake when we reported on such and such a date in such an article that," and then they'll give you five words, "it should have read no instead of yes." Well, you're not going to go back and pick up that article and read it and put the know where it belongs and then say, oh. And you see, now they haven't lied to you. They told you the truth. They deceived you by telling you the truth. They corrected their statement a week later. You think that's honest? Now, there's another technique here called falsifying key facts. Apparently, when a journalist has nothing to omit or to distort, he'll not hesitate to engage in the outright falsification of facts to please his boss and advance his paper's political agenda. Never has this been more forcefully and convincingly demonstrated than by the actions of now-disgraced New York Times reporter Jason Blair. A full account of his widespread acts of factual falsification and plagiarism, needless to repeat here, was detailed in the Times investigative report. Times reporter who resigned leaves long trail of deception. That was May 11, 2003. Briefly discussed in Chapter 1, one poignant example should suffice. In the fall of 2002, Howell Raines sent Jason Blair to Washington, D.C. to cover the Washington area sniper shootings occurring at that time, and shortly after arriving in Washington, Blair wrote a front-page story, "U.S. Sniper Case Seen as a Barrier to a Confession," October 30, 2002. That virtually accused the U.S. Attorney's Office of botching the prosecution of sniper suspect John Muhammad on the basis of several unnamed sources, Blair wrote, quote, "State and federal investigators said today that John Muhammad had been talking to them for more than an hour on the day of his arrest in the sniper shootings, explaining the roots of his anger when the U.S. attorney for Maryland told them to deliver him to Baltimore to face federal weapons charges and forcing them to end their interrogation. It did not look like the juvenile was going to talk," a local law enforcement official said, "but it looked like Muhammad was ready to share everything and that these guys were going to get a confession." Now, the article drew fire from the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI, both of which issued statements denying the central point of the article, that federal officials had cut short an interrogation by local law enforcement officials just as the suspect was about to confess. Concerns about the truth of the story were also raised with senior editors before the article was published by several veteran reporters in the Times Washington Bureau. 6 months later, in its investigative report of the Blair scandal, the Times admitted to Blair's falsification of facts and reflected upon its cause. When assigning Blair to the sniper story, Raines failed to tell Blair's supervising editors of the young reporter's history of shoddy work, saying he didn't want to stigmatize Blair. So, Jim Roberts, the Times national editor, and Nick Fox, the editor who supervised much of Blair's coverage of that sniper story, told the Times that Blair's reporting would have raised far more serious concerns in their minds had they been aware of the reporter's history of inaccuracy. Well, I can't imagine accepting unnamed sources from him as the basis of a story had we known what was going on, Fox said. If somebody had said, watch out for this guy, I would have questioned everything that he did. I can't even imagine being comfortable with the story at all. If I had known that the Metro editors flat out didn't trust him, Raines and Boyd, who knew more of Blair's history, also did not ask him to identify his sources. You know, one of the most important facets in court is identifying the source. We require in court, when we do a case, when I make a statement in a brief, the judge requires of me that I cite where I got that. He makes me cite Miranda versus Arizona or Yoder versus Wisconsin, chapter and verse. If I say to the judge, the Supreme Court says, or the Circuit Court of Appeals has said, I'm required to reveal my sources. The guy that wrote this book, Bob Cohn, is a lawyer. He recognizes the standards that the judicial system imposes upon all of us that practice before our courts, before our judges. They require that we be not, or that we not be shoddy in making claims and allegations. We have to have names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence. That's called proof. When you read newspaper articles that tell you, scientists believe, or scientists theorize, or it could be, or it may well be, these are theories, these are philosophies, these are beliefs, it's like religion. And it's reported in the news. The theory of evolution comes through our newspapers as if it's fact. Proven. It's nothing but philosophy. And most of what we read in the paper is just that. It's the slanted opinions, ideas, philosophies, and political biases of writers, journalists, editors, and newspaper owners. And they're foisting those ideas, philosophies, beliefs, and religious ideologies off on us as if it's the gospel truth spoken by God Almighty Himself. Let's take a break, and we'll be back with emphasizing the insignificant when we return. Now, you're listening to The Law Hour and The Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, when I'm asked who I would recommend for a lawyer, I recommend Jerry Spence of Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And that's because if you can't afford him, my second choice would be you. That's right. You know, you are the best person to represent your interests in court, and that's because you were there. And you either did it or you didn't do it. And you know who else was there. You know what was said. You know who said it. You know who's lying, and you know who's telling the truth. You know. But your lawyer doesn't know any more than you tell him. And besides that, nobody likes a lawyer anyway. You know, the abhorrence of the profession, the lawyer profession, is so well documented throughout Anglo-Saxon history that Shakespeare's Dick the Butcher in King Henry VI exclaimed, "The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers." Charles Dickens wrote, if there were no bad people, there would be no good lawyers. Poor Richard, in his almanac, said, God works wonders now and then. Behold a lawyer, an honest man. You know, so scorned were lawyers by the colonists that they were depicted as lawyer birds with their long bills and lawyer fish always slippery. And both Massachusetts and Rhode Island prohibited lawyers from serving in their colonial legislatures. Brigham Young, upon establishing his utopia in the Utah desert, characterized lawyers as a stink in the nostrils of every Latter-day Saint, and he described the courtroom as a cage of unclean birds, a den, and a kitchen of the devil. Early in the 19th century, the Baptist preacher John Leyland attacked a host of lawyers who infest our land like the swarms of locusts in Egypt and eat up every green thing. Well, representing yourself in court or at trial is protected by the Sixth Amendment, and it's protected by three rules, and that is, don't say anything, keep quiet, and shut up. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. That's a 4-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, informative, and it's free of charge. And you can write and ask for your free copy of our CD package by simply going to the webpage, georgegordon.org, click onto the email and send me an email request. That's georgegordon.org. Or you can call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, once more, we're talking about journalistic fraud and how the New York Times distorts the news and why it no longer can be trusted. One of the techniques, the fourth one, is emphasizing the insignificant. Newspapers sometimes can attack the credibility of its opponents, not just by omitting, distorting, or fabricating a key fact, but also by emphasizing on an otherwise insignificant fact in the context of a story. Now, in law, we use this cute little example. We ask the question, what is your mother's maiden name? Now, think of the question. What is your mother's maiden name? Answer, my grandmother eats Skippy peanut butter. I've answered the question, but I evaded the answer you were looking for. Now, that would immediately elicit from a prosecutor or an attorney in court an objection as being unresponsive to the question. Newspapers do this all the time, and of course the average Joe Sixpack on the street is not trained in those 42 exceptions or objections to the 188 rules of evidence. You see, there's 188 rules of evidence that we all use when we go into court, and there's 42 objections or exceptions to them. So, when I ask somebody a question and he's evasive, I know immediately that I'm starting to draw blood. If we were taught this in public school, when we read a newspaper, we would be on the alert for questions and then off-point answers. And that's what newspaper reporters are skilled at doing, emphasizing the insignificant. Change the subject. Don't answer the question. Answer a different question. Now, the well-oiled political wheels at the Times must have immediately begun to spin a variety of ideas on how to discredit the event. In August 2002, the Bush administration announced that it would hold a forum on the economy at which the president, vice president, and at least 7 members of the Bush cabinet would be joined by over 200 economists, government officials, small investors, teachers, workers, corporate executives, small business leaders, and professors. So the Times wants to squirrel this event, and the well-oiled political wheels at the Times did just that. And they began to spin a variety of ideas on how to discredit this event. So after the White House first announced who would be speaking at the event, the Times editors outdid themselves. Recall that the Times has led a 10-year multi-billion dollar crusade to convince the public that campaign contributions were the cause of government corruption. Since virtually every prominent business leader who would likely be asked to speak at the forum, or just about any conference like this, would have made a campaign contribution, what better way to discredit the forum than to suggest that some of its prominent participants were campaign donors? That's almost like saying, did you give money to the Salvation Army or to the Red Cross? Well, there must be something wicked, evil, awful, and terrible about you because you did that. Now, since the nation's privacy laws don't protect information about one's use of money for political causes, the details of the participants' political contributions are a matter of public record, easily accessible using online databases. Online databases. Thus, in a Times article covering the announcement of the Economic Forum, it was announced August 8, 2002, the unimpeachable business reputations of Charles Schwab, CEO of the stock exchange bearing his name, John Chambers, CEO of Cisco Systems, and Glenn Barton, CEO of Caterpillar, were impugned with a single headline: Bush's Forum on Economy is a feature GOP donors, or is to feature GOP donors. Well, what did you expect a Republican president to do? Bring in three Democratic donors, or three donors to the Democratic Party who are Democratic economists? I mean, come on, boys and girls, let's grow up and get real, shall we? Now, in a rare moment of candor, the Times did confess to the article, or in the article, that John Chambers had donated $250,000 to Democrats, and that other speakers included Charles Vest of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, who made political contributions to liberal Senator Edward Kennedy, Democrat of Massachusetts, and Speaker Tom Donahue, President of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, a Republican who donated to the campaign of liberal Senator Robert Torricelli, Democrat of New Jersey. Now, given those facts, how could the Times copy editor have possibly come up with the headline, Bush's Forum on Economy to feature GOP donors? You know, the thing that surprises me that Bush brought in these Democrats. That's the thing that's inconceivable to me. I wouldn't. If I was Bush, I wouldn't be bringing in Democratic donors to speak at my forum on the economy. Notice here that what we have is not just misleading. What we're doing here by emphasizing something is we emphasize that these guys give money to the Bush campaign. What we de-emphasize is that they also give money to the Democratic campaign. And that's very common in big business. You see, the big businessman, he doesn't care who he bribes. His objective is to bribe the politician so that when it's time for that politician to vote on something that has to do with Enron or communications, they'll vote for these corporate interests. They buy favors from Republicans and Democrats. They don't care. So they support Democrats and Republicans. They don't have any loyalties. And that's because the New World Order controls both the Republican and the Democratic parties. And both parties are big business parties. They're not working for Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife. So you might as well get that nonsense out of your head right now. All right, then the answer is that other than the mere announcement of the event itself, there was no newsworthy point of the article. Its purpose was simply to ridicule the event. Of course, that could have been accomplished by an opinion piece or a Times editorial. But that would not be nearly as effective as disguising the editor's ridicule in the form of an objective news story. So they put it on the front page as if this is an objective news story, when in reality, it's an opinion. It's a philosophy. It's a belief that we have. that has very little, if anything, to do with objective news. In fact, it's not objective news. It's biased and slanted philosophy, political philosophy. Now, the question is whether tomorrow's forum, which is reportedly going to include Republican donors and exclude administration critics, will do anything to resolve the administration's failure to speak with one reassuring voice on the economy. Now, that's the citation in the paper. But in truth, the forum, according to the original article itself, was going to include both Republican and Democratic donors, and in regards to the accusation that the forum would include, or exclude rather, administration critics. The invitation list hadn't even been completed. If, however, as the Times suggested, only GOP donors and administration supporters would be attending, wouldn't that have completely rectified what the Times deemed to be in the name of the same sentence as the administration's failure to speak with one reassuring voice on the economy? In other words, if all they brought in was Republicans, then how's that going to reassure the Democrats? It wouldn't make any difference if George Bush could walk on water. The Times would criticize him for getting the soles of his shoes wet. They'd say, aha! George Bush walked on water, but he got the soles of his shoes wet, and furthermore, his shoes were dirty and he polluted the water that he walked on. I'd say, give me a break. If the guy is telling the truth some of the time, let's give him credit for telling the truth some of the time, shall we? I mean, I've got a lot that I've criticized on this program concerning George Bush, namely the Patriot Act, Homeland Security, imagination-defying budget deficits, and the failure of the Bush and the Republicans to take control of our economy and return us to a gold-and-silver standard and dump paper money. I mean, it's coming anyway, whether we like it or not. But we could take firm positive action concerning Social Security and Medicare simply because it needs to be solved. But, you know, that's the third rail of politics, and we're not going to touch that. George Bush and the Republicans, like Clinton and the Democrats, do not want to tackle the tough issues. They don't want to do what has to be done. They want to get reelected. And as long as you've got politicians that want to get reelected, then our problem is always going to be, how in the world are we ever going to get anything that needs to be done done? The answer is it isn't going to be. And then what we're going to do is spend all of our time lying about these politicians. You see, we're going to lie about George Bush, and we're going to lie about what his objectives are. We're going to lie about Bill Clinton. I don't care if it's the New York Times lying about Bush or it's the Poughkeepsie news leader lying about Bill Clinton. It's my contention that telling the truth is a better practice for all of us than is lying. Well, we're about out of time. We'll be back here next time. We'll take another look here at journalistic fraud, how the New York Times distorts the news, and why it no longer can be trusted. When we return next time, that'll be tomorrow night. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and the Law Hour, please go to my website. It's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on my website. It's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log, schedule, and archives. It can be accessed through my website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Well, there's the signal. It says our time is up. We'll have to leave it right there. I'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing. So until then, good night, friends.